Hey, welcome to the Our Fikra podcast. My name is Mike Yumhenna. On today's episode, we speak with John Waterbury, the former president of the American University in Beirut. John talks about his new book, Missions Impossible. It's about higher education in the region and what's going on all across the region's universities and colleges. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everybody. My name is Mike Yumhenna. I'm excited about today's interview with John Waterbury. It's my honor to introduce our special guest. Dr. Waterbury was the 14th president of the American University of Beirut, AUB, in January 1998 and retired from the presidency in July 2008. Before joining AUB, he was for 20 years professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He specialized in the political economy of developing countries with a special focus on the Middle East. He was a director of Princeton Center of International Studies and editor of the academic journal World Politics from 1992 to 1998. For the year 2011, he was senior advisor to the Executive Affairs Authority of Abu Dhabi on higher education. John, welcome to Our Fikra.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
John, you are one of those people who, if I read your full bio, it would take me about 10 minutes. What I just read is only a snippet of what you've done. But what I'd like to do is go back to 1960 and try to figure out why you landed at the American University of Cairo in 1961. What were you doing there? And why were your sights focused on the Arabic-speaking world?
For reasons I can never fully explain, I decided to study Arabic when I was an undergraduate in college. And that was a random choice. I wanted to study a non-Western language. I think I suggested Chinese, but I was discouraged from doing Chinese. And somebody said, I've got a good friend who teaches Arabic. This was at Princeton. So on the strength of that recommendation, I started Arabic studies. And the rest is kind of history. I don't think I fell in love with the language, but I certainly was massively intrigued by it. It turned out to be, for me, probably the most logical language I ever studied. And then I decided I'd better study the region where it's spoken. And when I first started studying Arabic, I really wasn't terribly sure where Arabs lived. I had been aware of the Suez Crisis in 1956, so I knew something was going on out there, but I didn't have a good idea about that. So I started studying the Middle East politics, contemporary society in the Middle East. And then in my junior year, summer of my junior year, 1960, I actually went to Egypt. This was my first visit ever to the Middle East and to Egypt. And I spent the summer doing Arabic studies at the American University of Cairo, and I was hooked. I mean, it was very simple. And so when I graduated the following year, I was awarded a Fulbright grant as a student to go to Egypt and continue my Arabic studies, and that is what I did.
What was Egypt like for you? I mean, 1961 and 1962 are very important years in the history of Egypt. Nasser was extremely active in those times, a very transformational time in Egypt's history. What was it like being there?
It was, it was all brand new for me. So absolutely astounding, I thought. And I did some research in the summer of 1960 on the Nasserist system in Egypt. He was on the verge, as you intimated, of announcing his so-called socialist decrees, where most of the Egyptian private sector was brought under state ownership. It was really the apogee of Nasserism. He was still the hero of the Suez War, the most heard voice in the Arab world. He was emulated by everybody from Syria to Iraq to Libya to Sudan. So massively important guy, and I was trying in my own feeble way at that point to get a handle on how he ran his show. And but of course, Egypt never rests, and the Arab world never rests. So we had plenty going on. In the fall of 1961, when I first got there, the so-called United Arab Republic, the UAR, broke apart. Syria withdrew. but the UAR was dissolved. And that was the first time Nasser really had a negative punch in the face, as it were, from the rest of the Arab world. And he was angry. It was quite clear. But if I have time, I'll just give you one little anecdote. I was studying Arabic at Cairo University when the UAR broke up. I think it was actually in September 1961. And the students at Cairo University demonstrated in support of Nasser and denouncing the Infisaliyun in Syria. So it turns out that there was a rule at Cairo University that the students could, under no circumstances, demonstrate politically, even though this was in support of the regime. So they closed the university. And I had to relocate because my classes were suspended. I think they didn't get back into session for a couple of months. And so I transferred to the American University of Cairo to continue my Arabic studies. And that's what I did for the rest of the year.
Let's zoom down the road 30 years, Lebanon. In 1998, as I mentioned, you became the 14th president of the American University of Beirut. You weren't living in Lebanon at the time. You actively moved to Lebanon. And this is important because you were the first president to live in Lebanon after the assassination of Malcolm Kerr, who was also the president of AUB. So walk me through the decision to move to AUB, why you were attracted to this position, and the decision to live in Lebanon.
Well, to answer that, I may have to tell a story which I don't think I've told in public, as it were, before. But I had been approached when Bob Haddad, who had been president of AUB, resigned the presidency and went back to Northampton, where he lived. And I was approached by a trustee at that time to see if I'd be interested in being a candidate for president. So I think it was about 1994. And I asked, would I be allowed to live in Beirut? Because I knew there was a travel ban and a residency ban on American passport holders, which had been put in place by the State Department. It wasn't a decision of AUB or anything like that. It was the State Department didn't want American citizens in Lebanon for fear of kidnapping and ransoming and in some instances, death. So I knew about that, and I asked the chairman of the Board of Trustees, would I be allowed to live in Beirut? And he said, highly unlikely. And I said, well, then I'm not interested. And I dropped out of contention. 4 years later, the same trustee came to see me again in Princeton and said, the presidency is opening up. Would you be interested? And I asked him the same question, would I be allowed to live in Lebanon? He said, this time, I think you've got a 50-50 chance. And I said, okay, if I can go and live there, I'll take it up.
How familiar with Lebanon's as a country and as how familiar were you with the political system in Lebanon at the time?
Not sufficiently.
Well, I don't think anyone is ever sufficiently familiar.
Right. Look, Egypt with its 100 million is a simple read on its politics and its system as opposed to Lebanon. Lebanon, I learned to my dismay, is more complex than even I had imagined. In any case, just one anecdote on that. When I was living in Egypt in the 1980s, on and off, Malcolm Kerr was a frequent visitor. He supervised the UCLA students who went to Egypt on year abroad programs. So I was seeing Malcolm pretty often, and this was during the Lebanese Civil War. So I remember asking him, what the hell's going on in Lebanon? I just don't understand the animus and the nastiness and the causes of this war. And he would go through a very painstaking explanation, and I'd say to him, Malcolm, you've completely lost me. I don't understand this. You know, Lebanon is such a weird place. And he looked at me one time and said, John, mark my words, someday you're going to learn to love Lebanon. And I kind of laughed at him like, what? You out of your mind? I'm not going to go to Lebanon. And then lo and behold, I did go.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I want to move on to some of your books. As I mentioned, you've published extensively on Morocco, on Egypt, on the entire Middle East, mostly focused on on politics and economics and policy. But today's talk is going to primarily be focused on the book To the Left, Mission Impossible, Higher Education and Policymaking in the Arab World. I guess I want to talk to you specifically about maybe a good place to start is the title, Mission Impossible. Did you know that that would essentially be the title of the book before starting it? Or is that a conclusion you came to at the end saying, this is impossible. This this is not going to happen.
Well, before I answer the substance of your question, it's missions. It's plural.
Missions. Excuse me. Missions.
Yeah. And that's very important to my understanding. No, I didn't realize that that was going to be the title at the beginning. It came to me, I would say, in the middle of my research. I mean, I knew what I wanted to write about. I didn't know what I wanted to call it when it was done. But it, I was having very much the same feelings and reaction to the data I was looking at as I had with an earlier book called Exposed to Innumerable Delusions, which was a study of public sector enterprise in four countries, two in the Middle East, Turkey and Egypt. And what had struck me in that study was how many big meta missions states assigned to public sector enterprises generate employment, contribute to regional development, help the strategic plan move forward, build the infrastructure for their own military industrial complex, contribute to the education of citizens, vocational training, down a long, long list. And it meant they could never focus their resources and talent on one or two objectives that private sector enterprises are often able to do. And so I had already come to the conclusion that public sector enterprises had a kind of mission possible because they had so many competing missions put in front of them, often contradictory, that if you would try to achieve one, you had to sacrifice the other. And as I got into my study on higher education in the Middle East, I said that this is what I was finding with public sector enterprise. They're assigned missions from forming citizens for political systems to education for 21st century jobs to leading major research efforts, catalyzing private sector activity, you name it. It was kind of nation building all crammed into this one entity called the university. And I said, these are too many missions. They don't have the resources to fulfill even half of them. And a lot of these missions are competing. And that's where I think we may talk about the trilemma eventually. But that's where the trilemma came as a kind of analogy of the missions impossible.
Help us understand this concept of the trilemma as it relates to higher education, institutes of higher education in the book.
Right. Well, there you've got it. The trilemma is choices among cost, quantity, and quality. That covers a lot of what any university is interested in or a system of universities is interested in. That is to maximize the number of students who receive an education, do it at a reasonable cost, and keep up an acceptable level of quality. And my argument is that in the Arab world and just about anywhere, you can have two of those, but you can't have all three. So you've got to choose which two are most important and then sacrifice the third. So in the Arab world, the two that they worked the hardest on and succeeded pretty much in achieving was low cost and big quantity. Massification is often the term used, which I don't much like, but it is descriptive. But what got sacrificed was quality.
So before we get into some of the policy debates, I'm curious how you approached your mandate at AUB. What was appealing about that job? What you thought the major challenges that sort of lay ahead of you? And by the end of your tenure, what did you think your mandate and sort of legacy was over that span?
Yeah, it was something of a leap into the unknown to be present. I said that I knew a fair amount secondhand and a little bit firsthand about Lebanon, but I didn't know anything about running a university. I had remarkably little administrative experience. Wasn't quite sure what I was going to find. I knew by reputation that it was an extraordinary place. I mean, I had met so many people who had graduated from AUB and were on faculties throughout the United States and contributing in major ways. So I knew this place had a great track record, and that the Civil War had knocked it pretty hard, and they'd lost a lot of talent. Their finances were not in good shape, and that there were a lot of internal divisions that had been brought about by the conditions of civil war. So it was obvious to me that what my mission would be is trying to restore AUB to something like its former, I don't want to say grandeur, but its former richness and ability to lead intellectual endeavors in the Middle East. But that's easy to say. And I didn't know what the nuts and bolts were going to be at all. And I discovered pretty quickly, at least what I thought they would be, right in the first few months. And I was obliged to violate a recommendation that I had gotten from the president of Princeton University at the time. His name was Harold Shapiro. I went to Harold to say, "Harold, I'm going off to Beirut to run the American University of Beirut. What would you advise me?" And he said, "Look, don't take on too much too early. Take on a few things where you think you can score a major success or a victory, put a coonskin on the wall, and then you will establish a positive image among your constituents there, and you can move on to bigger stuff." Well, I thought that sounded like very good advice, but I got to AUB and some really big structural issues hit me right square in the face as soon as I got there, and I couldn't postpone them.
Okay, so I want to jump to this quote, which is from the book. I'm going to read it for those of you who can't see it. This comes after a long list of policy prescriptions and recommendations that are possible. Some really bad guys, parentheses, at the time of writing, there are no female heads of state in the Middle East and North Africa, could survive all of these reforms, but citizens and society would benefit. And what you're suggesting is here is even some really bad guys could survive these reforms. And so did you approach this book? Are there policy reforms that you are sort of left on the table because they're too disruptive, even though from your standpoint, they would completely help these missions impossible?
Yeah, I would be very surprised, although I don't rule it out, that universities as entities, as administrative and educational entities, would be given full authority over their basic internal affairs. These are the kinds of decision-making authorities that are very rarely found in Arab public universities. And I think most Arab leaders would be very reluctant to grant to their universities. I'd be surprised if we saw that implemented, other than in one or two highly specialized or kind of flagship universities that are being set up in the non-oil exporting states.
Okay, my last question before we go to the quick Q&A is, who do you suspect will be the agents for change? Who are the likely actors?
Right. Well, this is where I encountered a surprise in my own research. I was expecting to find that distance or virtual learning, distance learning, would be the big disruptive innovator because it could deliver a decent product at a fraction of the cost of a bricks and mortar university. And I thought just in cost terms, this might be the train coming through the tunnel that would blast out the old traditional universities. I don't think so now. It may have some of that impact, but not as much as I thought. What I think may be the disruptor, and it can be accommodated, is the private sector, which is growing rapidly in most Arab societies. And it has been granted a very different set of governance principles than public institutions. Most private institutions do enjoy a fair amount of autonomy. They are able to control a lot of the elements I mentioned with respect to KAUST in Saudi Arabia, over curriculum and missions and promoting and hiring, et cetera. Where I think it may be disruptive in a non-destructive way is that I can't imagine public institutions sitting around watching the private sector enjoy these rights and possibilities without being granted the same authorities, the same level of autonomy. I haven't seen a lot of evidence of that yet. But let's say if Arab countries are looking at China as an exemplar, the Chinese have said they want 20 of their universities in the top 100 within the next 15 years or something like that. I mean, this is what university autonomy is designed to do, help universities compete with one another. And China is jumping in with both feet. This is a highly autocratic, party-dominated, high-control system, and it's pushing individual universities to move ahead. We could see something like that moving into the Arab world.
I'm going to do this quick Q&A, and then we'll open up for questions real quick. And I should say that, John, I hope that we're able to have you back at some point, because there's so much other stuff to talk about outside of this book.
Be happy to do it.
All right, so the first question, what are you reading or watching right now?
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you before we went on that I'm teaching a group of seniors, in the sense of older people, a course on democratization in the Middle East. So I've been going through all of the literature on what is sometimes called Arab exceptionalism or the Arab democracy deficit, and why one would expect to see more democracy in societies like Arab societies than we actually do. And there's a ton of literature. All I can say is that it's full of contradictions and no consensus. So I don't have an easy message to give to my students. Yeah. But that's sort of where my reading is headed right now.
Is there a book that somebody, if we want to point in a specific direction, is there a book that sort of is at the top of mind?
Oh, that's a good question. There's a general book, not on the Arab world. There's a guy named John Tyrrell, J-A-N-T-R-L, who has done a book on democratic transitions, which I think is terrific. I don't have it sitting here, otherwise I could give you the exact title. But it's a really fine synthetic analysis, which touches fairly often on the Arab world, but isn't focused on the Arab world.
Okay, great. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. So who would you love to shadow for a day, past or present?
I would say any Arab head of state, because I've watched them at a distance for so long. I've never tracked them up close. I'd love to be trailing along, you name it, any of them.
So what do people most misunderstand about your work?
I don't know. I think I'm pretty simple in my writing and proposition. So it's not going to be confusion that overwhelms people. But they're always very complex situations. And as with the democracy deficit in the Middle East, there never seems to be a single explanatory variable to the answer. There's always a lot of on the one hand and on the other hand. I think people understand that, but may find it frustrating that I can't come out and say, yep, this is exactly the cause of the democracy deficit in the Arab world. If we can just concentrate on this one variable, we'll be able to solve the puzzle, because that's just not the way it works out. And I think most of my writing, I probably start because there's a big puzzle. And then when I get into it, I find out there's good reason for a big puzzle. It's really complex, yeah. And it's hard to nail down causality.
Yeah. Okay, last one. Whose work do you admire or are inspired by? I'm sure the list is long, but if there is one person that comes to mind.
Yeah, and it may be someone none of you have heard of, but it's a guy who I think should have won the Nobel Prize for Economics. His name is Mansoor Olson. And he wrote a book on the theory of collective action. And it was one that inspired a lot of work I did when I studied the sharing of water in the Nile Basin among 13 different sovereign nations. It's the same issue you'd find in the Colorado Basins among US states and Mexico, in any long river that goes across boundaries. And Mansur Olson had a whole theory on how collective action comes about among sovereign entities that aren't obliged to cooperate. And I found his work absolutely brilliant, very simple, very clear, and I applied it pretty extensively to my work on the Nile.
Great. Okay, thanks for that. So we have three questions. The first one comes from LM. If you want to unmute yourself.
Sure, thanks for the opportunity.
And if you can just choose one of your questions, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. My question is fairly quick, but given the current circumstances in Lebanon, and then the fact that you mentioned your tenure when you first came to AUB, I think that was post the civil war, and you mentioned that there was a bit of internal strife at the university. And I wanted to essentially ask you, how did you go about resolving that or amending the internal strife within the faculty or at the university the university environment overall to minimize the disruption of the learning experience, given that the outer environment was rather precarious?
I don't think I had a strategy focused like a laser on that issue, but a couple of things certainly alleviated the problem. One was to be as forward-looking as possible and not dwell on the past, try to move past the issues that had arisen. I'm not sure if you're an AUB graduate or not, but if you know AUB, you'll know that we had a campus in the Eastern Beirut called the Off-Campus Program, which was highly controversial. It catered to the Christian students of East Beirut who found it too difficult to go across the Green Line and into West Beirut. And two things happened pretty early on. We got a set of academic advisors and visitors funded by the Ford Foundation in Cairo to come out to AUB to review all of our programs, departments, programs of study, and make recommendations to us. And I think that had a tremendously positive impact on the faculty. Our faculty were re-engaging after so many years of being somewhat isolated and off anybody's radar. Here they were talking to the real leaders in their fields, interchanging with them and getting some ideas on how to move forward. And that went straight into a big academic planning effort, which again focused us on the future rather than dwelling on past problems.
Great. I'm going to ask Leila's question on her behalf just because we're running out of time. Leila, do you mind if I ask it?
No. Please do.
So please the question is, thanks, Leila. The question is, how do you see the future of education in Lebanon, seeing that the three main pillars of the Lebanese economy, banking, health, and education, are gradually falling apart?
I'm hoping to see Leila in New York in some weeks, so maybe I should save my answer. I don't know if I have an answer for that. I can't quite get my head around what's happening in Lebanon right now. It's almost cataclysmic, and so yeah, keeping talent is going to be extraordinarily difficult. Already is difficult. I'm sure AUB is not alone in losing faculty to positions outside the country altogether. For me, the faculty is the guts of any university. If your faculty loses quality and loses its cutting edge, then the university begins to slowly sink. But I think there will always be, I keep looking at the AUB faculty email exchange, and I'm always heartened to see so many familiar names and old friends who are still there giving us their thoughts by email on various issues facing the university.
Okay, great. John, this was a real pleasure to have you on. It's an honor to be able to talk to you about this work, and I hope we can repeat it in the future.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great fun.
Okay, everybody, enjoy your day or night wherever you are, and we will see you next time.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to watch the full uncut version, go to youtube.com/afikra. There you can see the full video versions of these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, go to afikra.com, where you can learn about our Zoom events, our live events in 30 different chapters around the world, our social media presence, and our podcasts and YouTube stuff. You should know that everything we do is all towards a mission of converting passive interest in the histories and cultures of the Arab world into an active intellectual curiosity. By listening to this, you're a part of that movement, so thank you for being here. If you'd like to support our work, go to afikra.com/support and join the hundreds of people around the world who make this work possible. Thanks.